From the Sky News Centre at 5, a couple from Manchester who allowed paedophiles to sexually abuse their two adopted girls have been jailed. The adoptive father was also found guilty in August of sexually abusing the elder child. He's been jailed for 9 years, while his wife has been sentenced to 5 years in prison. Our reporter Tessa Chapman, who's outside court, says the judge told them they committed a terrible betrayal of trust.
On one occasion, the mother said to the older girl when she complained of the abuse, she said, "I can't do anything. They're helping us out with money and a car." And on another occasion, she failed to take the younger daughter for medical attention after this abuse.
A man's been sentenced to 20 years for attempting to smuggle weapons and explosives into Northern Ireland. The judge says he was satisfied that Paul McCackerty was a senior and trusted member of the IRA. The 44-year-old from Lurgan was foiled by an elaborate MI5 sting operation. The Metropolitan Police has referred a suspected double suicide in southwest London to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The bodies of two women in their 20s were found inside a flat in Putney yesterday morning. Officials at the police watchdog will now consider whether to investigate further. BMW has announced it's recalling some of its cars because of a possible brake problem. 10,500 BMWs and over 900 Rolls-Royces are affected. Company spokesman Gavin Ward explains the reason for the action.
To help you stop a car, you have a degree of power assistance nowadays, and it's that element of the system that we're looking at. The braking system will still work on that car, it just won't work as we would like it to, so that's why we're taking this step.
Hundreds of worried parents have contacted Fisher-Price after it recalled around 250,000 toys and high chairs over safety fears. A consumer helpline's been set up for worried mums and dads. And the Ryder Cup is resuming at Celtic Manor. There's been no action on the opening day since around 9:45 this morning because of wet weather. Europe are 3-1 ahead in the opening four balls. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello, we're Permission to Dance on BCFM 93.2. I'm James Simmons.
And I'm Josh Evans. We bring you an hour of the biggest and hottest tracks every Friday night.
We bring you the official dance top 5, weekly bios on artists, all the latest info about the scene, upcoming events, and much more.
Be sure to tune in every Friday night at 9.
Yeah, that's right, every Friday night at 9 p.m.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest on the week the Labour Party chose a new leader is Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Mark Brain. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, former chief economist of Shell Oil, now the Coalition Government's Lib Dem Business Secretary, Vince Cable, gave a stirring speech at the Liberal Democrat conference last week, attacking the, quote, cosy magic circle of auditors, lawyers and investment bankers, unquote, in the city, at the same time announcing another bonanza for them, the sell-off of one of Britain's backbone services, the Royal Mail. Regional Secretary of the Communication Workers Union representing postal workers across the South West, Kevin Beazer, and John McAnally, the Vice President of the Civil Servants Union, PCS, will be giving their take on the LibCon Coalition's cuts and the jumble sale of services we pay our taxes for, and explain how to beat the recession. And faraway Colombia, notorious for its main crop, illegal cocaine production. But what's it like to live in Colombia these days? And is US influence bringing the country to the brink of war with neighbouring and oil-rich Venezuela? Martin Summer reports. That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. This weekend, highs of 16 degrees Celsius, a few sunny spells on Saturday with rain in the evening, wet on Sunday. Next week, highs of 17 Celsius, some sun this week, especially on Monday, and some showers, fairly windy midweek. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of October, highs of 13 Celsius, cooler all the time, fairly dry with some sunny spells next weekend. It actually sounds like next weekend is going to be quite a bit drier than this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Mark Brain. Welcome to Drive Time, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Now, first of all, Mark, as a councillor, what's your background? What were you doing before you became a councillor?
Well, what I still do now, which is work during the day, I was an Arrowsmith picket originally. I worked at Arrowsmith for 16 years,
the print factory. Okay, printing.
Yeah, in Ashton. And there was an industrial dispute, lasted 18 months. I spent 18 months on the picket line. Then I looked around to see what should I do next. Went to university, did a business degree, and at the same time joined the Labour Party. And one or two people said to me, you know, you ought to stand for the council. And the first couple of times people say this to you, you kind of, yeah, you know, but it's not really for me, is it? Can I really do something like that? And then I decided, you know, I was an agent, and I thought, I can do this. I saw it a bit closer. And so I decided to stand for the city council.
And so how long have you been a councillor for now?
7 years and a bit.
And what's your portfolio at the moment? What committees are you on?
I chair the audit committee.
Crikey, well, that's quite an important job, isn't it?
It is. It's
is that audit scrutiny? Is that looking at the bank accounts?
There are two different committees that deal with the resources. There's Resources Scrutiny Commission. That's a political committee. That's essentially about, do we want to spend money on this or not? Whereas the audit committee is, when we did spend money, did we report it properly? And also, are there risks to the council's finances? I know, like, if the city centre got flooded or there was a flu epidemic. It's all about assurance and making sure that things are safe, as it were.
So are they?
Yes, they are. Bristol does very well with that. It's also about counter fraud as well. We have an internal audit department who take care of that for us.
So you're the people that, if you think one of the council contracts has been awarded dodgily with brown envelopes, then you're the people to talk to.
The internal audit team, the professionals would do that, but they would bring it to us. Yes, it's usually it tends to be lower level than that. It has to be said. It tends to be people much further down the chain that are pocketing the money. We've only had a few really nasty ones over the couple of years I've been doing it. They tend to come out in the newspapers about a year or so later, because of the legal process and so on. So until people get charged, it doesn't come out. But it's safeguarding the public funds, because when people pay money in their council taxes, their hard-earned pennies, they want it to go on services. They don't want it to go in some, you know, crook's pocket, do they?
So are you happy that this new Lib Con coalition has taken away the audit commission? Because they sound to me doing a slightly similar role to what you're doing at the moment.
The audit commission appoint the council's external auditors, and they provide a number of services, including fraud initiatives, and they also provide comparison data, benchmarking, all of which is useful. On Wednesday, I spent the day in Nottingham with the chairs of audit committees from other major cities, from Birmingham, Nottingham, Liverpool, and Sheffield. And this was a topic for discussion, and indeed, you know, there are Lib Dem councillors that are not happy with this either, by the sound of it. The question is, what happens next? It seems to me as though the government has decided to abolish the Audit Commission with little idea of what is to replace it. I suppose it's okay to say, yes, we'll abolish it because we think we can do it better this way. They haven't thought that through. And the question is, how do we determine if a council is using its resources effectively and providing the best services, you know, it can, if there's no means of comparing what that council does with another council down the road? Other, you know, people have no idea what they're voting for and whether they're being properly served.
Now, Bristol didn't come out too well in the latest Audit Commission report here. Things like the housing benefit service that they provide to some of the most vulnerable in society came out with a zero rating. Basically, they couldn't have got a worse rating.
The Audit Commission don't actually cover our finances. We have a firm of chartered accountants called Grant Thornton. The Audit Commission do cover most councils, but a proportion they hand out to the private sector, and you don't get a say in who they are. Grant Thornton were appointed to us by the Audit Commission. By and large, we do get very good reports from Grant Thornton. They've our accounts are always unqualified. They're not serious deficiencies in them, and with regard to service delivery, then that varies from, you know, it's inevitably going to vary across a council in terms of the finance functions, in terms of internal audit. We do very well.
Okay, now your day job is at the Home Office. Briefly, what do you do?
Not much. No, that's... I mess around with numbers. It's very dull.
No, but what's your actual job description then? What kind of, you know, we need to know something about it.
I'm an accounting assistant.
Okay, accounting assistant at the Home Office. Anyway, Martin Summers is with us too, as you may have just heard off mic there. Martin, why is George Osborne paying billions in interest to the banks when the Bank of England lending rate is virtually zero?
Well, I mean, they're basically giving the banks free money, which they then lend on to the rest of society at a markup. And you may well ask why they're doing
that. Well, it's not just the rest of society, it's the government too, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Well, the government is part of the rest of society, isn't it? It's a rather anomalous situation.
Why doesn't the government borrow this money directly from the Bank of England rather than... Because one of the things we've been hearing the last couple of weeks is that actually it's the interest payments on the national debt which are crippling.
As you know, Tony, on this programme we've discussed various strategies for monetary reform and reform of the financial sector. But what's actually going on is an unwillingness to contemplate the radical reforms that might be necessary, because people are basically stuck in a rut.
Such as,
for example, you were mentioning the possibility that the government could actually create money directly and spend it directly into the economy rather than via
quantitative easing.
Well, quantitative easing all goes to the banks, yeah. But monetary reformers like the people we've had on in the past, and that's not only one of the things that's being suggested. We basically subcontract the right to print money to the private banks. And then when they misuse that privilege, we withdraw the contract. No, we bail them out, and that's why we're in a mess. And we need to radically reform the financial system. But there'll be no political will to radically reform the financial system until conventional remedies have failed. Shouldn't be the case, but that's the way it will be politically.
Mark, as an accountant auditor, what's your view on all this?
It is a great tragedy that we are, that it's the ordinary person in the street, and particularly those in the public sector, that are having to pay the price for the behaviour of the banks, and we're seeing it happening again in Ireland now, aren't we, this last 24 hours. I mean, nobody's suggesting that the Irish government has done a poor job of running the country for the last, God, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. They've been a success story by and large, but they've now got to bail out the Anglo-Irish Bank, and I think the tune to which they have to bail them out to is the equivalent of the entire tax take of the Irish government. It's not a big country, and they don't have a large population, and they don't have the leeway that other countries do. It'll be public sector workers in Ireland that'll be paying the price there too.
But surely, I mean, these banks, I mean, they've already bailed out this Anglo-Irish Bank in Ireland, as you mentioned there, before being told, this is the money we need in order to survive. And now it's almost that the bank is almost like the guy from the mafia is coming around and knocking on the door again and saying, look, we're going to crash the economy unless you give us another load of money. How long is this going to go on for?
In Ireland, I don't know. I've not studied the Irish situation. I was quite surprised to hear about it myself today. In terms of the British banks, there aren't any more to rescue. I would hope at some point they can be sold off, and we can start getting some of this money back. But the banks were not properly regulated in the first place, and that's why we are where we are.
Well, that's the Labour government's fault, isn't it? You're a Labour councillor.
Which means I'm not never part of Labour government, of course. But no, it's an international community, because if one country regulates its banks strictly, they just clear off somewhere else. Gordon Brown was right in this, in that you have to pursue regulation across the world. If you don't tackle these issues globally, then they won't be tackled.
Yeah, I think I do agree that we need global action to deal with the problems. I'm not so sure that we do want to actually sell the banks off, or even that is feasible. I feel that what will happen is we're going to go into deflation now because of the condemned policy of public expenditure cuts. In Ireland, the government were responsible for allowing the kind of approach that was adopted over the last 20 years is the cause of the crisis for them. Their crisis is particularly acute because of their laissez-faire philosophy. I think ultimately the real reform of the banking system is only going to come after the second leg of the crisis has been fully experienced by the society.
Now, actually, what's happening, though, is that Vince Cable and the Lib Con Coalition are going to sort this out. They actually, what makes you think there's going to be any more of a crisis? Because that's what they're doing
now. That's what they are saying, but I suspect that what they are going to do, and it's not, to be honest with you, the situation we're in, whoever was in power would find it very difficult to manage the situation. But nevertheless, I do not believe that cutting public expenditure in Britain, Ireland, anywhere else. Are we suggesting that the Chinese should cut public expenditure to balance their books? Because if they do, the Chinese economy will crash and carry everybody out down with it. There's been an unwillingness by many people in authority, whether it's financial or political, to get to take stock of the real seriousness of what's happened since 2008. It's not just a minor hiccup. The private banking system has effectively collapsed. The banks are effectively insolvent, and at some point, as Keynes said in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. And that's not political rhetoric, it's a statement of logical fact. Debts that can't be paid won't be paid. Countries like Iceland are going to repudiate their debts. Ireland quite possibly may have to leave the euro, just as Greece may have to leave the euro. These kind of things will happen in the next phase of the crisis. And at that point, people will start to think, hang on, we're going to have to do something more here than just bail the boat out.
Would you agree with that? That's a pretty gloomy view, Mark.
I do not understand the Greek or Irish economies enough to be able to say whether they will have to leave the euro or not. I hope they don't. But I couldn't say one way or the other. I do believe that the economic outlook is not promising. Yes, I mean there's a leader in today's Economist saying that there's some they fear that the cuts are so severe that actually they're going to damage recovery, which is what we've been saying all along.
Yeah.
If the economy doesn't go into a double dip recession, which is what we expect from Ireland, it certainly will grind along at very, very low growth for a long time. And I agree with that analysis. Where I depart from The Economist, of course, is that their answer to the problem isn't to not bring in the cuts. Their answer to the problem is to have a few tax cuts in the kind of sort of 1980s Ronald Reagan trickle-down economics.
Unbelievable. I mean, I find it absolutely extraordinary that after all of the evidence we've had that this doesn't work, they're saying it's like that cartoon Roadrunner where the coyote carries on trying to catch the Roadrunner, even though everything he does goes completely wrong. As I said last week on this show, Tony, with the Liberal Trevor Blythe here, I would be perfectly happy for a Conservative government to take the right steps, and the right steps are not to deflate the economy. We're going to have a global reflationary strategy in Europe and in the US, and we're going to have to work very hard. And that means throwing out of the window the textbook that was written in 1979 by Reagan and Thatcher. It's all wrong. There were no redeeming features. The reason why we're in the biggest economic crisis since World War II is precisely because of Reagan and Thatcher. And when the Conservatives can recognise that, then they're fit to govern.
Well, both of you should be absolutely overjoyed because you've got the Labour Party has got a new leader this week, and so let's have a little dip into his inaugural speech at the Labour Party conference, and I'll be asking you both what you make of him.
And we should learn the basic lessons of history too. After 1945, we had the biggest debt we ever had. That generation did cut the deficit, but we know they had a bigger vision, a vision for our economy and a good society. True patriotism is about reducing the debt burden we pass on to our kids. But Mr. Cameron, true patriotism is also about building an economy and a society fit for our kids to live in.
As Ed Miliband in his inaugural speech at the Labour Party conference this week. Mark, can I ask you first, what do you make of that and what do you make of Ed?
Well, I think Ed was pretty much saying what we've just been saying here in the studio. Yes, and we don't want to saddle our children with the repaying of a load of debt. Actually, I don't want to be saddled with repaying a load of debt myself. It's not just the children, it's about the here and now as well, isn't it? Turning to what I make of Ed Miliband, I think he's going to be a fine leader. He was not my first choice when I voted.
So who was?
Andy Burnham. I felt Andy Burnham represented the centre ground of the party, which is roughly speaking where I am. And I knew all along Andy wasn't going to win, but I wanted him to get my vote to make sure he got a good seat in the shadow cabinet and got a good portfolio, because I felt he was valuable. I don't think I would have screamed and run out of the room tearing my hair out. Whoever had won, they all had fine qualities. But I'm happy with Ed Miliband. He was my second choice.
Ed Miliband was my second choice. My first choice was Diane Abbott. But
sounds like he may have been lots of Labour Party members' second choice.
Oh, yes.
That's why he won.
That's why he won. That's exactly why he won. I didn't expect Diane to win either, but I felt that the left needed to have its voice heard. And again, looking for place for in the shadow cabinet for her, possibly. Mm. I think Ed Miliband's point about 1945 was very well made. Very well made. You can't cut a deficit by crashing the economy. The deficit gets bigger. That's what we learned in the 1980s when Geoffrey Howe was the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And it seems to me quite extraordinary that the Tories are still drinking this snake oil, but even more extraordinary that the Liberals, who used to have a very good reputation in terms of understanding the nuances of this, they seem to have drunk the Kool-Aid as well.
Sounds to me, Martin, like you think the economy's going to crash, even though we're starting to hear now it's picking up.
Well, people say, I don't want to predict things because nobody can predict things. I think Danny Blanchflower said, as soon as the government, who used to sit on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, the guy who called the recession right all the way down the line, as soon as the Con Dems were elected and said they were going to cut public expenditure, he said, I'm not guessing that there's going to be a double-dip recession, I'm 100% certain. 100% certain. Because this is the only result of cutting. We've seen this in Ireland, they've been cutting like mad for 2 years. People have had a 20% cut in wages in the public sector if they've kept their jobs. It hasn't helped them. It's made the situation worse. And it's like, at a certain point, you have to say, hang on, we're in a hole, stop digging.
Okay, so let's have another listen to another little excerpt from Ed's great inaugural speech.
It is a huge challenge to change our economy for the future. And I tell you this, the same old thinking will lead to the same old results. An economy too dependent on financial services, too many people stuck in low pay, and growing inequality. We need a plan for change, a plan to reform the banks, invest in the industries of the future, and support the small businesses and entrepreneurs who are the lifeblood of this economy.
That's Ed Miliband again. Mark, can you just say what you think? Actually saying we need a plan for change doesn't sound all that exciting to me.
He's been in the job for a couple of days when he's making this speech. He's got to appoint a shadow chancellor, which he can't do before his shadow cabinet has been elected by the...
Doesn't he have a plan? Parliament.
Well, you'd have to ask him. I can't see inside his head, but... he's got to appoint a shadow chancellor first, and at that point they have to come together with a plan for government when we win the next election.
So don't you think that just like everybody in politics, he's just trotting out, oh, we have to have a plan for change. He's using the word change again and again and again to make out there's going to be some difference. But actually, most voters, certainly many voters, think that most of the main parties seem to be really rather aligned with each other, so there won't be any change.
Well, there are a lot of people who think that, and I think they are profoundly wrong. Most of the main parties are not the same. You do get people say that to you. You know, there's no point in voting, you're all the same. It's rubbish. It's absolute... It's patent rubbish. We can see it right now before our very eyes. We can see the cuts programme from the Tories, you know, which the Labour Party would have had to reduce the deficit, yes, but not like this. And we've seen the for example in schools, we've seen the academy program being, well, perverted, if you like, because the whole idea of it was to help schools in areas where academic achievement was poor. This is now being all turned around so that they can provide more money for the schools that are doing well already, so the rich can get better education and the poor don't. That's what it's all about. So it isn't true that all parties are the same. And if anybody is still in any doubt at this point in time, wait until we've had the comprehensive spending review at the end of October, and that begins to get implemented next spring. Because if you don't know about it now, you'll know about it then.
Martin, we need a plan for change. Doesn't sound like he really knows what he's doing.
Well, I mean, all politicians have to work within a certain rhetorical framework. I mean, we need a plan for change is not wrong, it's just obvious and therefore trivial. But of course it's true, we do need a plan for change. And when he says we, he doesn't mean the Labour Party, he means the country. I suspect that even if the Tories cling to power for the next 2 or 3 years, they will have to change their policy. Because they will be staring into the abyss if they don't.
Well, they're already having trouble, aren't they, with this leaked letter from Liam Fox about defence spending cuts.
Yes, well, that just shows the kind of difficulties they're going to have.
They have their own internal divisions, yes, and Liam Fox has always been very strong on defence, and of course he doesn't want to see his particular pet, as it were, starved of funds.
Apparently the Ministry of Defence police are crawling all over the Ministry of Defence and other places to find out where this leaked letter came from in the Cabinet Office.
You never know, we might find out. But I doubt it.
Okay, Martin. We've also had to say goodbye this week to Alistair Darling. And I'm not really sure what you both thought of him as a Chancellor, but is it right that he's completely bowing out of politics now and he's had to say goodbye to the Labour Party?
He won't say goodbye to the Labour Party. I mean, people do leave public life and do actually say goodbye. He won't say goodbye to the Labour Party. No, he's going to still be a Member of Parliament, isn't he? But... He's now moving to the backbenches, presumably, and because he knows that when the Labour Party comes to power in a few years' time, it's going to need to bring in a new team.
So let's have a listen to Alistair's words of wisdom at the Labour Party conference.
We change Britain for the better in ways big and small, and pride as well in how we stopped the worst financial crisis for over 60 years, becoming another Great Depression. Because that's what the Tories and the Liberals conveniently forget as they try and con the country into believing the deficit is a result of extravagant spending decisions or reckless decisions. It was not. The deficit is the result of the banking crisis and the economic crisis that followed it. It's why every other country in the developed world is facing higher borrowing. Yes, we did take decisive action to stop businesses closing, people losing their homes and thousands more being thrown out of work. And without this action, borrowing would not have been lower in the long run, but higher. Of course, there was another choice. We could have sat back and done nothing, letting people sink or swim. If we'd listened to the same Tories who now decry our record, that's exactly what would have happened. When Northern Rock first ran into trouble, the Tories said, let the market take its course and let the bank fail. When we intervened to support the wider banking system, the Tories opposed us. But we understood that if the banks failed, it wouldn't have been the bankers that paid the price. It will be the businesses who used them, the jobs they supported, the millions who used their services to save or to borrow.
That's Alistair Darling speaking at this week's Labour Party conference. Martin, do you think that we're going to be... it's right for the Labour Party to say goodbye to its front bench spokesman, Alistair Darling, who was Chancellor?
Well, I mean... You know, it's like everything else in football. You know, you can't keep choosing the same people. Eventually, you've got to choose some new people, otherwise you don't win the games.
Quite right.
And Alistair Darling defended his record there. I think that what Darling and Gordon Brown did in the height of the credit crunch 2 years ago was extraordinary and exceptional and would not have happened under other leaders. But I also hold them both responsible for not tackling the City of London previously. When Brian Gould left Britain, he was one of the founders of New Labour, he left Britain to go back to be an academic in New Zealand, and he said, if you people aren't prepared to take on the City of London, we're all wasting our time. And it became clear that the Labour Party wasn't prepared to take on the City of London, so Brian went back to Auckland. Now, that is the big problem of New Labour, is that they basically did not reform the City of London, and they should have done. Now, of course, when it came, the crisis came, they did actually do decisive things that others wouldn't have done.
Now, isn't it right to say that without sort of actually making friends with the city, that New Labour would not have got elected in 1997?
Well, that was the problem for them, wasn't it? Tactically, that was exactly the problem, because getting elected and doing something sensible when you get there are often two contradictory things.
Okay, Mark, let's just speculate a little bit here. Who would you like to see on the new, not necessarily new Labour, but on the new Labour front bench team?
Yes, there is a slight difference, isn't there? I'd like to see Ed Balls and Yvette Cooper both get decent jobs.
So this is Ed Miliband and David Miliband, and it's all a sort of family affair now it's becoming, isn't it?
Because
David Miliband's out of it. I mean, Ed Balls, not Ed Miliband.
Yeah. No, I know, but we've just had a contest between the two brothers. Now you're talking about a cabinet with a husband and wife.
Parliament's not sitting at the moment. It's hard to find news stories, and they've had the press have had a good old run with the Miliband brothers, and you know. But that's generally speaking what's happened, and that's all over now. David Miliband has gone to the back benches, and now I think editors in what used to be Fleet Street are now turning around and saying, well, that worked quite well, now we can do the same with Ed Balls and his wife.
But do you think it's right that family, it's becoming a bit of feudal kind of thing, politics these days, with families, brothers and sisters all looking after each other at the top?
Well, people who are members of the same family do often have similar political points of view and are often members of the same political party. I think there was a family in America in the 60s called the Kennedys who
were all members.
Yeah, they were all members of the same political party as well. No one ever suggested
that. There were some Bushes as well.
There are a couple of Bushes around, yes.
So we're taking on the American model over here now, are we?
No, I'm just saying it's a natural thing, isn't it, that they've had in the Conservative Party in the past there have been members that have been married to one another. We've had it in the council chamber in Bristol. There are no husband and wife teams at the moment, but there have been several in the past, and it's just a natural thing. My own daughter stood for city council on the last elections in Knowle, it's happening in my family too.
Anyway, it's just gone 5:30. Time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Mark Brain, Labour MP. Sorry, not quite Labour MP. Labour councillor's choice of music. Now, so Mark, what's the song and why did you choose it?
The song is called "On the Turning Away" and it's by Pink Floyd. It's not one of their longer pieces.
So, why this one?
Why this one? It was written in the late 1980s at the height of the Thatcherism, and it was it's all about how there is such a thing as a society, and that we are our brother's keepers, and the world needed to be a better place and a more considerate place, which was pretty obvious to many of us under Thatcherism, and I just think that we're moving back into a similar situation where the song becomes relevant once more.
On the turning away from the pale and downtrodden and the words they say which we won't understand, don't accept that what's happening is just a case of all the suffering, or you'll find that you're joining in the turning away. It's a sin that somehow light is changing to shadow and casting proud over all we have known. Oh, the world, how the ranks have grown, driven on by a heart of stone. We
You're listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. That was On the Turning Away by Pink Floyd, which is chosen by today, well, it still is actually, chosen by today's guest, Mark Brain. A quick reminder of BCFM Friday Drive Time website, where you can see and even hear all the previous shows back to Easter 2009, and listen again if you want. That's at www.thisweek.org.uk. That's one word, thisweek.org.uk. Now, back to our news review with Labour councillor Mark Brain. Mark, first of all, in our second half of this hour, we've heard news this week in the Evening Post that the First Bus are to be cutting 26 drivers. Or actually, no, 26 drivers have left. So First Bus are telling us that I'm afraid they're going to have to cut their services because their bus drivers are leaving. Apparently, the services affected are the 6 from the centre to Longwell Green, the 7 from the centre to Staple Hill, the 8 and 9 Templemead Circular, 75 from Hengrove to Cribbs Causeway, and the 76 for Hengrove to Henbury. Buses will run less frequently on all routes during the day. Now, how on earth have they managed to get themselves into this, as you described it as we were in the break there, as such a pickle?
Yes, they're good at this, aren't they? First group getting themselves into a pickle. It seems to me as though they can't possibly have spoken to these drivers before they did, you know, and consulted with their own staff before they made such a decision, because they wouldn't find themselves in this position if they did.
So they're blaming the drivers for leaving.
Yes, it's all their fault for deciding to go to get a job somewhere else. That's the first line, first group line. They're saying they're recruiting. They've recruited 35 other drivers, and that sometime in the future the services will come back to normal.
But there seems to be some mixed messages as well here, because one of the bosses from First Bus, whose name I can't quite find right now, but anyway, he says, unfortunately, we can only run buses on a commercial basis where there are enough passengers to support the route. This is not the case with the service 53A and 53C.
Yes.
So it seems that there's a sort of mixed message. It's Tony McNiff, who's managing director of First Bristol, Somerset and Avon.
I don't know,
there's
Tony.
Mixed messages, aren't there? What is going on here? Martin, have you got any idea?
Well, can I stick with this one a bit, because this actually affects my ward directly, so I have a slight interest in this. This all started when First Group slashed the 52 route, and that seriously affected people in my ward, because it was the only route that connected Hartcliffe and Withywood with Bristol South Crematorium and the cemetery there. There were a lot of elderly people who could no longer visit the graves of their loved ones, and feeling guilty about that. And that's a terrible human cost, isn't it? Now, there were campaigns all around to try and save the route or to do something else about it. A small one-man company called City Star came in and took care of the routes in the Bishopsworth area. And yeah, he's done a splendid job. And Dawn Primola was part of the campaign as well. And we were hoping that the 52 would be restored. What eventually came out of it was, in response to pressure from Dawn Primola and from councillors in Filwood and Hartcliffe and other places, that the 53 service was introduced by First Group, but they didn't run it from my ward. They ran it from Filwood. So we were left out both sides then. But even that, what was, I don't know, was it a SOP or did they ever intend to run it properly? I don't know. But even that is now being abolished. And it's very frustrating for a city councillor. The city council has no control really over the buses. We can subsidise routes and that's it. If Bristol had been able, with its neighbouring councils, had been able to bring in an integrated transport authority, as we had the power to under the last Labour government, then we would have had more control over the bus companies like First Group.
Look, but if you can't do things like this to actually get transport working in the city, what is the point of voting for people? You know, if they can't actually make sure that people can get to work and get away from work with and actually have a reliable transport system that works, what is the point of the Bristol City Council?
The point of voting is to get, is to bring in a system whereby you can control the transport. The problem is that whilst people are voted in a bit of a mixed way in Bristol, they voted Conservative in all the neighbouring authorities and they didn't want anything to do with it. And it was the Conservative councils in North Somerset, in Baines, and lastly in South Gloss, that basically scuppered this whole integrated transport authority plan, and it's for that reason we don't have the control over the buses and we're left powerless. I remember an occasion some years ago now when Bristol, when First Group raised their bus fares, and there was a motion to Bristol City Council saying, "Isn't it terrible?" And they should not raise their bus fares. And I think all three parties voted for that one. First Group raised the fares anyway. People in Bristol, especially older people in Bristol, remember a time when Bristol City Council owned and ran the buses. And then, in those days, the City Council could tell the buses what to do, and they could make sure that a proper service was provided in the areas that needed them, not just the ones that make the money. Well, that's no longer the case, and hasn't been the case for a very long time.
Well, Labour has just come out from a long term in central government, so why hasn't the system been changed by your party at Westminster, so that you do have some power?
The system was changed and the possibility for an integrated transport authority was introduced, but you have to have some autonomy for local councils, and the councils around us, Conservative controlled, alas, did not participate.
It's not fair just to blame it on neighbouring authorities. Surely you've got to bite the bullet and take some responsibility here.
Well, what would you suggest?
I think what you're mistaking here is that at the level that Brian is working on, you're working within constraints which you can't change. Now, what's happened, of course, is the privatisation of bus services in the 1980s, which is still trumpeted by the Conservatives as a fantastic success, like most of the other privatisation reforms, has turned out to be a pig in a poke. Yeah. Basically a mess. I mean, people looking from Denmark or Sweden at the way we run our local bus services just scratch their heads in despair. I mean, what are you doing? You've taken your whole system back to a fragmented system of 50 years ago. Why did you do that? Well, we did it because we had a Conservative government which was stuffed full of ideology, and then we had a new Labour government which didn't have enough ideology to overturn that previous mistake. We see we haven't renationalised the railways, for example. They did that in New Zealand. Labour renationalised the railways in New Zealand. Now, I'm not saying that politics is the art of the possible, and in this country, the vested interests of estate agents, bus companies, banks dominate the political discourse. And in the past, Labour has not been sufficiently robust in dealing with those vested interests. Let's hope as we go forward, we rediscover our roots and our. And I mean, what is wrong with having a bus service, a transport service run by the local municipality? It's normal stuff in other parts of Europe.
But is it actually possible? Is that just totally pie in the sky, Mark?
What, for a local authority to run? We did it for a very long time, for decades in this country.
Exactly.
Yeah. If First Group is actually the final monster that grew out of the Bristol City Council, country bus service. Badger Line, some people may remember, when it was first privatised, it became Badger Line, and bit by bit it grew like Topsy. Now, it was Mrs. Thatcher's great vision for buses was a kind of Adam Smith utopia.
Yes, she said that anybody over the age of 30 who rides on a bus is clearly a failure. Yes. You remember that statement?
But she envisaged like 20 different bus companies in a city like Bristol, all competing, all jostling for position, and thus providing the best service through market forces. Well, it didn't work, and it didn't work because she didn't read her Adam Smith properly. Adam Smith said, all markets tend towards monopoly. And that's what happened. It actually went to duopoly. And the big bus companies drove people off the road. There used to be a company called Ambassador Travel. People in Hartcliffe and Bedminster will remember this bus company. One man band, he bought himself a green double-decker bus, and he started running a route from the centre out to Hartcliffe, and he did it at a cheaper price than what was then City Line did. Well, their response was to buy a load of second-hand buses from Cardiff, paint them all sky blue, get a load of non-union labour to run the buses a few minutes ahead of Ambassador Travel and charge less money. And then when they'd run him off the road, the sky blue buses all disappeared and it all went back to First Group again. They are under threat now. I mean, people like the University of West of England Students' Union are running their own buses. So there are some brave attempts. But that's the kind of behaviour you expect from a monopolist or a duopolist.
Look, I'm fed up with hearing about doom and gloom about First Bus. What are you going to do about it, Mark?
I've just told you we can't do the Bristol City Council do anything about it at all.
And don't forget that the Labour Party isn't even in power in the Bristol City Council. So
it's completely impossible.
What can be done? What do you think? I mean, there must be some light at the end of the tunnel here. We're not just going to have a bus service that slowly runs into the ground and grinds to a halt.
Over what time period? Well, what can we do within the next couple of years? I would say very little. I don't believe that a Tory government is going to empower local councils to run bus services. It's just not going to happen. So as long as we have a Tory government, nothing is going to happen.
Well, perhaps that spot needs to change, but we need to have a vision of the future which will look a lot like the past. If we look at the way the economy and society was managed in the 1950s, we might find there are a lot of lessons for us. And don't forget, we had Conservative governments in the 1950s who managed the economy in a completely different way from what we're seeing now. Completely different way. And that was as a result of the lessons learned in World War II, that having a plan and having a mixed economy is actually the sensible, moderate course. And all this free market stuff is nonsense and always was nonsense.
Right, on to another story. And MI5, it seems, are doing overtime, doing what they can to make sure they keep their budget in the spending cuts. Because the last few weeks, 2 weeks ago, we had a terror threat about Somalis. Last week, it was the Irish that we had to be worried about. And this week, it's a Mumbai-style terror attack on European cities, which they've foiled, even though there's been actually no arrests. A terror plot, we're told, by Pakistan-based militants to launch Mumbai-style attacks in Britain and other European countries has been foiled by the intelligence agencies. Am I being too cynical, Martin? Do you think
It says here intelligence sources, so it doesn't mean MI5 necessarily. It just means somebody, whoever that might be.
Am I being too cynical saying that they're just angling to make sure they keep their budget?
Well, what I feel about things like this is that I simply don't trust a word these people say, whoever they are. What happened in Mumbai is incredibly murky. We do know that one of the people that was captured turned out to be working for the Americans. Many people in Pakistan believe that the research and analysis wing of the Indian Army had some kind of hand in what happened in Mumbai. I'm not saying yes or no. I have no idea. But people shouldn't presume, when they're told stories like this, that the people telling the stories are entirely unbiased or haven't got an axe to grind. What's happened with the war on terror is we now really can't trust sources of information. We've got, you know, we've basically got to take everything said by everybody with a big pinch of salt.
Mark, do you think, am I being too cynical saying all these terror plots we're hearing about the last 3 or 4 weeks are to do with the security services trying to make sure they keep their budget, as everyone is jostling to keep their budget with George Osborne?
Certainly is pretty cynical. I don't know whether it's MI5 or not, because you can't tell from this. Depends where the operation took place, doesn't it? Because MI5 operate in Britain, but not outside. So they say.
If it's talking about European cities, which I imagine would include British cities.
All I've got is the news report that's in front of me, and I think with a thing like this, it's just dangerous to read too much into it, particularly as this happens to come from the Daily Mail.
this has been used to justify several drone attacks inside Pakistan, which have killed quite a lot of people, and the Pakistani government very upset and angry about it. Democratically elected Pakistani government, but of course, it's all justified because there's this plot which we can't tell you about, which is going to happen, but we've now foiled it. I mean, people from Belfast, for example, tend to be rather cynical about statements like that coming from the British intelligence services. I'll put it no more strongly than that.
Well, you mentioned Pakistan there. We've got another story about Pakistan this week, just the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. Pakistan has halted NATO supplies through its country after an attack into their territory across the border from Afghanistan by NATO helicopters, trucks and fuel tankers for foreign forces in Afghanistan was stopped at one of the border posts in the Khyber tribal region near the city of Peshawar hours after a raid across into Pakistan, which killed some of the Pakistan military by NATO. Things seem to be hotting up in Pakistan, Martin, don't they?
They do. It's a very sad situation. We've got the floods, which have obviously been very devastating, and lots of people have lost their lives and probably still will lose their lives. And the country itself is being destabilised by foreign meddling.
Sorry,
the Indians and the Israelis as well.
We're not in Afghanistan and Pakistan to destabilise there, Martin, surely?
Well, it depends how you view it, doesn't it? From a Pakistani point of view, the NATO intervention in Afghanistan is creating enormous problems for them internally. They don't see us as stabilising the situation, but rather as destabilising their situation. I think it's very complicated and very sad, because there's all of these terrorist attacks going on inside Pakistan, lots of innocent people are being killed, and it's not quite clear who's doing what to who. There's all sorts of complications in it, and it's very easy from this sort of distance to say we know what's going on. We don't. It's a very sad situation.
Essentially, Mark, this seems to be a bit of a blue-on-blue incident where NATO helicopters have actually killed Pakistani military in Pakistan. This seems to be a bit of a mess-up. Shouldn't we just withdraw? What are we doing there?
On the basis of this? No. When the military are involved in any situation, you do get situations like this. Somebody told me that on D-Day, a British ship was sunk by American fire. That's World War II. This sort of thing is not new, and it's not unusual. Clearly, this is the complicating factor here is the fact it's taking place in Pakistani territory, whereas the NATO forces are in operation in Afghanistan. It is a difficult situation.
So shouldn't NATO be checking their maps before they go on missions?
I'm sure they have more than maps. I'm sure they have GPS and so on. It is a difficult situation for the Pakistani government, because they've got a number of interests to balance, as a government does in any country. But it's far more difficult for them. They've got to defeat terror at the same time as preserving their own sovereignty and not looking like an American puppet. It's a difficult balancing act for the Pakistani government to pull off.
So what do you think the mission... What are we actually doing over in Afghanistan? What's your view of all that?
My view of all that is that the situation in Afghanistan is much worse now because we got distracted with Iraq. And in fact, Afghanistan was always should have been the greater priority of the two. Indeed, we now know that Iraq should have happened in the first place, but it wasn't necessarily obvious at the time. But the intervention in Afghanistan had to happen.
What are we doing there? Why should we be there?
We are there in order to support a fledgling and flawed democracy. To improve that democracy and to allow the Afghan people in the end to run their own country, to have a country that doesn't act as a base for terrorist attacks. The terrorist attacks would happen even if we weren't doing this, probably more so. Into the bargain, we got to overthrow the Taliban regime, which was one of the nastiest regimes in the world.
But at the moment, the regime in Afghanistan is not really democratic, is it? We were hearing a couple of weeks ago that actually the government officials, a lot of them are being paid by the US Central Intelligence Agency. They're not even being paid by their own government. So
they've got the money.
Martin, what are your thoughts about Afghanistan and this particular incident?
Well, this incident is... obviously, you can't make policy on the basis of a particular incident, although it's a very worrying incident, because, of course, you've got, you know, the Pakistani army fighting with NATO forces, effectively. I mean, that's where we're going if we're not careful here. I think I agree that the intervention in Iraq did divert from Afghanistan, and I'd also make the point that you can't then rewind the tape and say, let's go back and do Afghanistan. You may have lost Afghanistan at that point because you didn't pay attention, and you can't just rewind the tape and say, let's do it again. I would also argue that intervention in Afghanistan by NATO is not seen by people around the world as an act of either of justified revenge or as an act of altruism. It's seen by the Russians, for example, by the Chinese, by the Iranians, as sticking your finger into our zone and trying to control what we want to do, what you want us to do. It's geopolitics underlying all of this. It's to do with oil. It's to do with money. Don't forget that in the 1980s we supported the Mujahideen to the extent of allowing them to drug deal. The CIA were very involved in drug deals in Pakistan during this period. If you read the Pakistani English language press, as I do, you will see that educated people in Pakistan simply do not believe that we are there out of altruistic motives. And they also suspect that many of the terrorist attacks carried out in Pakistan and in Iran are being supported by CIA in particular and by the Indian Army Research and Analysis Wing. And this is all logical stuff. Yeah, we are not the good guys with white hats. We are in a very morally messy zone here. So, and maybe we should follow British public opinion, which is over 70% in favour of a withdrawal of British troops from Afghanistan. Most mainstream politicians don't take point of this, but in actual fact, the British people have already made up their mind. We don't want to fight about Afghanistan.
Afghanistan is a long way away, Mark, isn't it? And is it wise to be fiddling around in the Russians' backyard, as Martin?
Because it's a long way away, we might upset Iran and China. Am I that bothered about upsetting Iran and China? Not really, no. The Chinese government is one that imprisons people because of the religious beliefs they hold. The Chinese government oppresses Muslims themselves far more than Western countries have ever done. They have the death penalty for over 100 offences, many of which, you know, are things like embezzlement. And then we have Iran, a Holocaust denying country. No, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna. I don't think Britain should be making its foreign policy on the basis of whether we upset Iran or China. Russia, perhaps a different story.
All right, let's mention Russia then. We've mentioned this chap on this programme many, many times, and perhaps you could go and Google him when you go home. General Leonid Ivashov was commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001. As far as he's concerned, it was Mossad and the CIA that carried out the 9/11 attacks, and that's the head of the Russian armed forces. Now, he may be lying, and he may be making mischief, but most people in Britain are unaware that that is the actual take by the Russian general staff on what's going on in Afghanistan.
Okay, now it's a very final, quick story. Last story is the legal setback for the biomass objectors. We've talked about this a couple of times. The biomass plant, it seems the campaign group determined to block plans for the biomass plant, suffered a major setback at the High Court. They're moving ahead, apparently, Helios Energy, with a scheme for a 200 million plant. Now, you must have come across this, the biomass plant. What are your thoughts on this, Mark, finally?
Well, it's one of these news items that makes me glad that I don't sit on planning committees. In planning, if people keep applying for the same thing long enough and changing it, eventually it'll go through. Right? And that's going to happen here with the biomass thing. I am not in favour of the biomass plant. I don't think this is a credible solution to global warming, and it's all a ruse.
It's a bit like First Bus, isn't it? Well, not much we can do about it.
There isn't that much you can do about it, no. Planning law is bent in favour of the applicant.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Mark Brain. After the news, and former chief economist at Shell Oil, now the coalition government's Lib Dem business secretary, Vince Cable, gave a stirring speech at the Liberal Democrat conference, attacking the cosy magic circle of auditors, lawyers and investment bankers, at the same time announcing another bonanza for them, the sell-off of the Royal Mail. We're joined by two trade unionists, Communications Workers Union and the PCS, after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol